Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, July 21, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss antitrust enforcement in the modern era. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest, the Honorable Joshua D. Wright. He's a professor of law in the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, right here in the Washington, D.C. area. He's going to give us some opening remarks of about 15 to 20 minutes or so, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind. Without further ado, Josh Wright, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. I thought what I might do to start is walk through sort of what to expect. I think that's probably the question most folks are interested in, what to expect out of the antitrust agencies sort of moving forward. I've given a talk along those lines now, you know, maybe once a month for the past several months. And, you know, the most frequently asked question is, well, nothing's changed yet, so when is it going to change? When are we, in the FTC case in particular, when we are going to get personnel and what's that going to mean? So it still hasn't happened. We still don't have nominations on the one front, and we'll get to talk about personnel a little bit too. But I thought I'd spend some time talking about personnel at the agency, sort of the state of play, what's likely to happen, when it's likely to happen, and then turn a little bit to, you know, at least in my view, what to expect out of both agencies moving forward after personnel get put into place. That is an easier target to shoot at the DOJ, where we know the identity of the personnel, and so we can talk at least a little bit with more precision about that. But it probably makes sense as an organizational principle when talking about what to expect to sort of split up the agency. So why don't I do the FTC first in short, because we know a lot less about who's going and when they're going. The agency, as I suspect most of the folks calling in will know, is down to two commissioners, something that I don't think, certainly not in the modern era, has happened. I don't think it's happened ever, at least for more than a transitory period of time. So the agency is down to two, with no nominations to fill seats having taken place yet. And so it is currently split 1-1 with acting Chairman Olhausen and Commissioner McSweeney, whose term expires in towards the end of September. And so much of the speculation has been about who will be appointed, when they will be appointed. That is a fun game to engage in. I read all the same headlines that folks read about personnel, but I think one of the interesting things to point out about what's happened at the FTC, at least so far, in terms of the last 6 months, I think it would be very difficult to distinguish the agency's, say, merger policy from that over the past, the 8 years of the Obama administration. There's not much difference there. I suspect that will change on the margin. We can get into that a little bit later as well. But I think it's sort of fair to say that until there's new personnel at the Federal Trade Commission, there is unlikely to be much policy change. I do think if one looks at the the rumored personnel, I mean, there's talks of various congressional staffers in both parties, and, you know, maybe an antitrust practitioner or two, et cetera. No matter who the personnel are, I think one of the sort of most obvious implications of where we stand at the FTC, I mean, just in terms of timing, down to two, the administration is going to have to do three nominations either which way. There will be three folks nominated, two Republicans and a Democrat. It will take some time to get background investigations done. It'll take some time to set hearings. And if, C-SPAN watching the Senate is any indicator, they'll take a substantial time to get folks confirmed as well. I think from a practitioner standpoint, one of the most obvious implications of that sort of timing is that it tends to be the case in the absence of agency leadership that sort of more of the locus of decision-making power is shifted from upstairs in the commissioner's offices downstairs into the staff. And so I think probably for at least 6 months you're going to see a little bit more steering the ship from staff than one would normally expect to see when a new administration comes into power. On top of that, it will not be long. Commissioner McSweeney's term ends in about 2 months, and Chairman Olhausen may be named the permanent chair, in which case there's another commissioner to be appointed. She may serve out her term, in which case we're a year away from another commissioner. In either event, there are going to be five new commissioners in all likelihood within the next 12 months. And that is something that I think in terms of upheaval at the commission has just not been seen in a long time. Speaking from some experience of being a new commissioner who went into the agency with a substantial amount of antitrust experience, but not much on the consumer protection side, just the learning curve when you get in the building, the amount of sort of drinking from the fire hose that is happening when you start, it takes a while to learn, where the bathrooms are, much less sort of everything about jurisdictional coverage, getting up to speed, sort of getting your feet wet and being able to sort of get up to full speed. So I suspect that the FTC, no matter who get put into those positions, and maybe we could talk about that in Q&A if people are interested in the specifics on who they think or what have you. No matter who it is, we're talking about, I think, a time period where there's going to be sort of a substantial shift in agenda setting away from what you would normally think, sort of chair-driven and commissioner-driven, while these things are settled. And that's, I think, one shift that's important. Slightly different implications depending on whether we're talking about merger enforcement or IP or conduct, because the staff is in different places on different subject matter. But I think an important happening at the agency until things get settled. On the DOJ side, personnel is a little bit easier because we've got folks identified. Obviously, a couple of DAGs have been put in already, Bryson Bachman and Don Kemp, chief economist sort of on the way shortly, maybe other DAGs coming in and making Delrahim waiting for his vote. I think, at least with respect to the DOJ, it will be a little bit easier to talk about what to expect out of the agency, since we've identified personnel. So I think maybe I'll shift a little bit now to talking about what I think one should expect. It is, I think I mentioned I have done, a dozen or so what to expect out of the agencies or what does Trump antitrust mean panels. And the most frequently asked question is, hey, listen, the president tweets about antitrust sometimes. What about political interference with the decisions of either the Antitrust Division or the Federal Trade Commission? And it is not difficult to see where those questions come from. I am on Twitter. I see the tweets. But in terms of actual implications for shifts in the Antitrust Division, I think most of those concerns have been at least in the absence of strong evidence to the contrary, I think most of those questions come from a level of concern that I think is probably a little bit overrated, or maybe a lot overrated. My sense is, knowing the folks at the FTC and knowing Macon and I mean, one can get this sense from listening to his answers during his confirmation hearing as well. My expectation, and I think the expectation that practitioners and, you know, onlookers, folks who care about antitrust that the agency should have, is that these are law enforcement agencies. The political appointees running them consider them law enforcement agencies. The staffers who are very influential inside the agencies consider their job to be law enforcement. I suspect very much that both at the DOJ and FTC, the influence from outside forces, outside political forces, whether they be Senate hearings or tweets from the White House or what have you, are not likely to be as strong as I think what folks are expecting. I mean, pressure from a White House or a Senate is not unheard of when it comes to antitrust enforcement, though it is rare. And so I don't expect, just to sort of get you know, what not to expect out of the way, I don't expect much in terms of a, you know, a large shift in terms of political interference with either agency. Of course, we'll have to wait and see. But I think it is worth, both in terms of both that it is the correct answer, and I think the correct default answer for somebody like Machen at the DOJ, who's a serious antitrust guy, who has a serious record and is a thoughtful guy, that he's going to go into the job and enforce the antitrust laws and, you know, apply a lot of fact. Sort of in, and that I think is the, you know, the correct thing to expect. So that's a little bit in the way of what I expect not to change. Maybe for a couple of minutes, we can talk about things that I do think will change at the agencies. And again, maybe we're splitting the FTC and DOJ for these purposes. You know, the FTC, again, a little bit harder. You know, personnel is policy, and we've got to wait and see who comes into these jobs. But in terms of overall trends, we can start there. I think what you people should expect to see from the new administration on antitrust enforcement in mergers will be not a lot of change. I mean, if you look historically over shifts from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration through the Obama years sort of to present, the story in mergers has been maybe the marginal merger challenge shifts from a 5-4 or a 6-5 in an especially aggressive antitrust regime versus, you know, 5-4, 4-3 in a Republican administration. And I think you can expect to see the same kind of marginal shift on big deals. You know, that won't necessarily show up in the number of challenges, right? If the marginal merger shifts from 5-4 to 4-3, you get a bunch more 4-3s proposed, right? So I think you'll have the enforcement numbers will look fairly similar, but a little bit of shift in composition with what changes. I think you can still expect the FTC to be fairly active in the healthcare space, hospital mergers, retail, places where it has been active to date. I don't think any of that will change significantly. And in merger enforcement, I really do think what you will see is sort of the, as much as people would like a more exciting story, that's not what I've got on offer with respect to mergers. I think you'll see a sort of tame shift, you know, a slightly less aggressive approach on mergers. One area where I do think you can expect to see some change is vertical mergers. The FTC and the DOJ, I think during the Obama administration, had gotten a little bit more adventurous on vertical deals. Still not many. We're talking about sort of one or two as opposed to zero. Still not many, but I think we're sort of feeling out, getting a little bit more adventurous on, you know, one or two deals. I expect that that will not be the case. And the consensus view sort of across Democrat and Republican administrations at the FTC and DOJ for the past, you know, 20 years, you know, based on sort of standard antitrust economic principles, has been that it is not impossible, but a fairly rare occasion on which a vertical merger raises competition concerns under the antitrust laws. I think that consensus is well founded, has been around a long time, and will continue to stand. So I don't think you'll expect to see much activity there. At the DOJ, I think there is at least one easy target for obvious change that we could talk about, or if people have questions about, I'd be happy to talk more about. I would say, and I was inside the Federal Trade Commission during the Obama administration, and I think if you were to ask me what the biggest shift was inside the agency during those years, I would say antitrust agency treatment of IP rights. The use, increasing use of the antitrust laws to curtail IP rights. I think that was the biggest shift, and I think it happened at both the FTC and DOJ, and I think it happened both in enforcement actions and in policy speeches. Part of that is the rise of attacks on IP rights of American companies from foreign agencies, but also with respect to the domestic agencies. You've got the FTC sued against Qualcomm, among others, as an example of that trend. That is an area, unlike mergers, where I don't think the type of sort of evidence-based consistency on merger analysis really exists on the IP side. So it tends to be a little bit more of a, intellectual and legal and economic dogfight. So there, I think, I'll use Macon as an example. I think Macon has been, has long been interested in the intersection of IP and antitrust. I think has long been a critic of over-reliance on antitrust to impose limits on the exercise of intellectual property rights. And I think, if you look back and look at his testimony in the Antitrust Modernization Commission or some of his testimony in the Senate hearing, it is pretty clear that this is an area that he cares deeply about. I think this is a good development, sort of having cited that area as one of the most problematic during the Obama administration. I think more than anything, leadership at the agencies to take on some of those issues, both domestically and internationally, is a difficult problem to solve. It's an important one, in my view, probably the most important one facing the agencies. And this is one where it is not too provocative to predict that Macon will likely change the course of the DOJ on this subject, given his prior interest. But if I were to single out an area as being the most ripe for more than sort of a nuanced marginal shift in policy, I would single out that area. Let me close in the last sort of minute here with areas that I think are worth attention for change, but where I'm a little bit less confident that we will see any change. There are plenty of things that a Republican administration can and should do, in my view, in the agencies that are worthy of attention. Take, for example, the horizontal merger guidelines, which get revised sort of every so often, 82, 92, 97, 2010. The big contribution of the 2010 guidelines was to revamp the way we think about, not to revamp the way we think, but to update the way the agency communicates its analytical framework to the public on unilateral effects mergers, a little bit on coordinated effects. These were ways to update the agency's guidelines with respect to how it treats its own burden of proof, right? The sort of plaintiff's prima facie case in a merger challenge under Section 7 of the Clayton Act. But the guidelines haven't done much on the agency's treatment on the supply side, entry inefficiencies, for quite some time. At least 1997 was the last time the guidelines were substantially changed on that front. It is my view those are ripe for change. That's something I've written about. And I think it's sort of an obvious policy area to pick off for a Republican commissioner, sort of update the way the antitrust agencies are treating and thinking about efficiencies. Don't know if that will happen. I mean, that the sort of projects with the horizontal merger guidelines, there's often talk about vertical merger guidelines. That has been an idea proposed by both administrations over time, but hasn't been done. I think the agencies, that idea is certainly ripe for discussion, whether one wants to do it or not. But most of these ideas, updating the horizontal merger guidelines, introducing vertical merger guidelines, HSR reform, most of these ideas are the types of ideas that require coordination and cooperation from both agencies. And, you know, that's just sort of unlikely to be a high priority until you get sort of a full boat of leadership at both agencies. So I think we're talking about, you know, 6 months until a year until you can get the agencies' heads together on some of those major policy issues. So I think until then, we're really talking about kind of what directional changes, what, you know, what tack you can change for the agency in case selection. And that's a big, you know, case selection's a really big deal. But I think we'll tend to see marginal change on mergers, larger change on IP and antitrust, both in sort of rhetoric and policy and enforcement action, but not much in the way of sort of joint, you know, agency guidelines and some of the other big $64,000 items you might think the agencies are or ought be interested in. I think we're just sort of still in wait and see mode. I promised to make my intro 20 minutes. My clock says 20 minutes, so I'm going to stop there. And Dean, happy to punt to Q&A or whatever else you'd like to do.
Very good. Let's go right to Q&A. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate so. So once again, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who might ring in. A quick announcement about our next upcoming Teleform conference call, scheduled for Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be talking about the use of statistics in civil rights law. That's Monday at 2 p.m. at this same number. Today, push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question for our guest. Let me get things started here, if I could. You're mentioning possible changes in the analysis of horizontal mergers, vertical mergers, rather, I'm sorry, and that the Obama administration had been a little more, I can't remember the exact word you used, you didn't say aggressive, but you used a word similar to that, and that the coming administration might be less likely to look askance at vertical mergers. I wondered if you could just explain why that should be the case, especially with regard to vertical versus horizontal mergers.
Sure, Dean. The consensus, I think the word I used was something like adventurous with respect to vertical mergers. The FTC certainly had, and when I say adventurous, I mean, goodness, while I was there, I can think of one, maybe two consent decrees where there was a vertical merger issue tucked into a larger horizontal deal, but sort of nothing where vertical theories of antitrust harm were the headline of the show. But even that sort of exploratory poking around one or two vertical theories was an uptick. I mean, the consensus in antitrust for a long time has been there's agreement both that vertical mergers are generally pro-competitive, and I'll get back to the why on that in a second, but also sort of on the other side, I mean, this is not an argument that vertical mergers can never harm competition sort of as a law of the universe, but the economics both in terms of the conditions needed that must be satisfied for vertical mergers to benefit competition versus the conditions that must be satisfied in order to generate some harm are pretty well understood economic principles that have been around now, 20, 25 years. It turns out, not as a theoretical matter, but as an empirical matter, the conditions needed for vertical mergers to harm competition are rarely met, and it's fairly easy to understand why. I mean, vertical merger, first, sort of naturally doesn't impact the level of horizontal rivalry, right? This is two firms that don't compete in the same market, or, you know, at least the analysis is about purchasing complementary assets rather than assets that compete with one another. And so the theoretical sort of stories about how buying, purchasing vertically complementary related assets might harm competition are all to do with how the owner of those assets might discriminate against rivals in one way or another, stop selling to them, or sell to them at a higher price in order to hurt some competitor at the horizontal, you know, at its own horizontal level. So, you know, this is, you know, Coca-Cola buying shelf space to preclude Pepsi from having access to it, not unlike what we see in exclusive dealing type cases. And it turns out this is an incredibly expensive venture for, you know, in that case, for Coca-Cola to do, right? It's got to buy up an awful lot of shelf space in order to preclude its rival from sort of being able to compete for its own. There's a long economics literature suggesting how difficult and costly this might be. That doesn't mean it's impossible, right? And so much of the, I would say, late 80s, 90s, early 2000s are attempts by industrial organization economists to go out and say, look, we've got theories about vertical relationships helping competition, and we've got theories about vertical relationships harming competition. What economists like to do when you have theories battling theories is go to the evidence, test them. There's a, you know, and so there's been something, you know, 30, 40, some odd papers, you know, peer-reviewed analyses by serious economists trying to go out into the world using a variety of methodologies and sort of test these theories to see how often they explain what we observe in the real world. The one I most often, the paper I most often like to talk about, especially in an audience of non-economists, is there's a literature survey. This is, you know, occasionally we have these in law reviews, but more often in economics journals. Somebody does the hard work of going through all 50 papers, not just reading their abstracts, but sort of going through the methods and understanding what they did, and synthesizes that literature into sort of a single, you know, a single piece to try to communicate sort of our general cumulative knowledge to the world. Francine LaFontaine, who is a excellent IO economist, she was a bureau director in the Bureau of Economics at the FTC during the Obama administration, and is a professor at University of Michigan and a very, very well-respected industrial organization economist. Francine has a paper in a, you know, fancy, prestigious economics journal that does exactly this with respect to vertical integration. And what they find, sort of doing the work of going through all of these studies, is, sure, we can find, you know, one or two examples of vertical mergers where we've got competitive problems, but not many. And the overwhelming thrust of that literature, I don't have the paper in front of me, but the overwhelming thrust of economist attempt to sort of do their best to empirically measure the effects of real vertical mergers is that they are not just generally, but overwhelmingly generally, almost always likely to increase output, increase consumer welfare in some way or another. That is not a result that's demanded by theory, which is why, you know, the antitrust division, it's got, you know, it's got a big vertical deal in front of it right now. I'm sure someone somewhere will ask the AT&T Time Warner question. You know, this is a big vertical deal that's in front of the agencies, and there are, you know, theories that one could raise that are, you know, people in all vertical mergers can raise theories, just like in all horizontal mergers. And this is fact-intensive stuff. This is, you know, agencies understand those theories. The staff at the DOJ deal with those theories all the time. In every case where a vertical transaction arises, they know what evidence to look for. And it turns out, by looking at the agencies, if you look at the number of agency challenges and vertical cases that have occurred over the past decade or two, the number is low. I think I described one or two over a couple of year time period as high. That's not because the agencies don't want to bring cases. That has not been my experience with the agencies at all. They want to bring cases. It's difficult to find a vertical case to win. And what it takes to win is showing that the merger is likely to harm competition. And so what you see out of the agencies on vertical mergers is exactly in line with one would expect to see if they read and took seriously the economics literature, which is difficult for vertical mergers to create market power and harm competition. The empirical literature in economics is consistent and indeed verifies the idea that finding anti-competitive mergers, vertical mergers in the wild is a difficult thing to do. And I think the policy and enforcement decisions out of the antitrust agencies sort of are in line with that. So, what the agencies do when they get these cases is they understand the theories. The theories have testable implications, right, about what one would expect to see. They understand those theories. They sort of work through them and make a decision. I don't think, AT&T Time Warner or, any other vertical deal in front of the agencies is any different. These guys are sort of well experienced with these theories. They work through the evidence and do what they're going to do. And I don't expect this one to be any different.
Very good. If you have a question for Josh Wright, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We do have two callers with questions. Let's take our first question of the day.
Yes, hi.
Hello. Go right ahead, caller.
Thanks very much. It's Laura Peterson. Thanks for your presentation, Joshua. And I've heard frequent references, including a discussion by you today of anticipated changes in the IP antitrust interface, but I'd very much appreciate some detail, as much detail as you feel you have time to provide on just what these changes might be. Thanks.
Sure. This is a subject I talk about a lot and care deeply about, so I could take us well over our time limit and kill the rest of your afternoon, but I promise not to do that. Instead, let me highlight a couple of specific areas in response to your question that I think are sort of what I would anticipate as being reasonable and plausible, maybe even likely targets for shifts in administration policy with respect to IP and antitrust. So a couple of things. One, let me do the FTC first because I know it best. So the FTC, over the past 8 years, there have been a number of changes at the intersection of IP and antitrust. Take, for example, the FTC, under its unfair methods of competition authority under Section 5 of the FTC Act, has a handful of settlements in which it has asserted the theory that a patent owner, a standard essential patent owner, violating its license agreement with a standard setting organization, without more, that breach of a contract by itself violates the antitrust laws. That, without getting sort of too much into the legal details, is a fairly controversial proposition. I happen to think it's wrong as a matter of law and policy. But for our purposes, suffice it to say, it's a fairly controversial policy. No federal court has ever held the same, that breach of a license agreement by itself also violates the antitrust laws in the absence of, the patent holder engaging in some form of deception or something along those lines. The FTC has settlements articulating a theory sort of contrary to what we see in federal court, that is, breach alone violates the antitrust laws. That's a pretty controversial stance. That is a very aggressive use of the antitrust laws available to the FTC to curtail IP rights. I was a critic of that position while I was at the FTC. Acting Chair Olhausen was a critic of that position and has dissents in those settlements. So I think that is a high-profile area where at the FTC one might expect the policy position to change, and one might expect an incoming agency to change that policy in a highly visible way. But maybe the biggest area to think about there is in the international arena. I was at the FTC, and certainly Acting Chair Olhausen has been present and an important voice on this issue as well, but the use of antitrust laws, not just by the FTC, but by international antitrust agencies to impose limits on the exercise of the IP rights of American companies has been an issue that has received increasing attention. It received a good deal of attention well before the FTC suit against Qualcomm, with a 2-1 vote over the dissent of the chair in the Northern District of California. But that development has certainly raised the profile of that issue as well. But I think for a long time, an important policy issue for the U.S. antitrust agencies has been to the extent that foreign competition agencies having either different substantive views about the antitrust laws, which is certainly the case for some jurisdictions, or different views on the appropriate use of the competition laws, say to promote national champions or so forth, or to reach some other sort of political sort of ends. That has been an increasing phenomena, and one that I think calls for more attention from the leadership from the U.S. antitrust agencies. I think that one probably can't expect that out of the FTC until we're sort of back to full capacity. But at the DOJ, that is an area where I expect the Assistant Attorney General will view laying out the DOJ's views on the use of antitrust to limit IP rights as sort of a high priority policy item. There are specific manifestations of that. There's the IEEE business review letter that came out of the DOJ during the Obama administration. My own view is take some policy positions that are probably deleterious to economic growth and American companies' IP. I suspect getting rid of that thing might be a reasonable target for the DOJ. I certainly don't know that they will do it, but if I was trying to come up with a list for you of areas of reasonable targets, that would certainly be one. I expect that you might see less in the way of enforcement actions around things like product hopping cases in the pharma industry, although that's a little bit less clear. So those are a couple of examples for you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are wide open. I'm listening to your conversation, and that strikes me as one area that based on what I heard during the campaign of the Trump of the Trump candidacy, I suppose, that seems to be right in the wheelhouse of the Trump administration, I would expect. This is just my reading. When a foreign company uses its competition laws, almost weaponizing them to the disadvantage of American businesses in a way that favors the sort of foreign national businesses, and really represents sort of I don't know if it's corruption might be too strong a word, or manipulation of trade agreements. Is that a fair way to characterize that? Is that the way an administration like the Trump administration might view the international antitrust issues you've just described?
I think it's fair, if not slightly incomplete in the following sense, Dean. I mean, some of the actions we see, and one of the big changes that's happened in the antitrust world over the past, let's say, 30 years, is we've gone from a handful of agencies to something like 125, 130. Okay, IRS is the most important change in the antitrust enforcement landscape that's happened during my lifetime, to be sure. Now, some of that happens because countries need to have an antitrust law and an antitrust agency to participate in certain international agreements, right? So, so they create an antitrust agency, and now what, right? The U.S. has been doing this for a long time. Europe's been doing it for a long time. Some of these agencies are more experienced than others. So sometimes I think what you're seeing at new agencies are good old-fashioned growing pains, right? If one were to look at what the U.S. agencies looked at like from 1890 to 1900, you know, nobody would write a happy story about that either. These agencies were, you know, figuring it out and developing capacity. A lot of these agencies don't have economists inside or lawyers who have specialized in antitrust for a significant period of time. You know, others have that sort of capacity. So for some of these international decisions we see, you might think of a sort of a regulatory capture using the agency to sort of engage in trade war story as fitting the facts, and I think that's certainly right. But I think it's important to note that for some of these agencies, and this makes the job trickier for the leadership of the U.S. agencies, for some of these agencies, they're just new. They're new to this and not very good at it. And so whatever way they come out on their analysis, they may come out, you know, as being more interventionist than the U.S., maybe less interventionist. But the mode of analysis is not very developed, and they're doing capacity building. And so the U.S. has played a very influential role in through its Office of International Affairs, which does a very nice job, and the DOJ as well, is giving technical assistance to these countries that need it and ask for it, to trying to help build capacity, sort of to being a friend in that regard. And so I think the strategic question for the agencies is, you know, how do we keep that role as helping the agencies that need it, but get a little tougher with the ones that are clearly using the antitrust laws of their own country I think weaponizing is a fair word. And that is a tough strategy to design. It is one that I think you're absolutely right, given sort of what came out of the Trump administration during the campaign, is one that I expect that they'll be interested in. I think it is one that Machen's already interested in. So I think we'll see some action there. And I expect that it will be, sort of a tougher stance from the U.S. agencies with respect to foreign agencies. How tough, I think, is a little bit of an open question, but I'd bet my money on a lot tougher. The other complication here, not to drag on my answer too long, but just sort of to highlight, the other complication, this is a much easier problem for the DOJ than the FTC, right? The FTC's got, will have five commissioners. You know, different people with different views on these subjects. You've got, folks writing dissents, and, you know, you've got to thread needles about getting sort of multiple commissioners on board. The FTC also has its own problem in this regard. I mean, the FTC has a suit against Qualcomm in the Northern District of California voted out, you know, a couple of days before the president left office, President Obama left office, in what looks like, at least I think one could fairly say, and this is my personal view, but one could fairly say looks like a case that's involving, you know, sort of a political attack on IP rights, involving, you know, domestic fights between, U.S. IP holders versus, you know, folks who want to license that IP, where the FTC was itself weaponized to take a side in a fight between some big sophisticated companies. What you worry about and have to worry about at the FTC is the ability to, what you're going to hear back from international agencies if you're the FTC trying to offer up these, kernels of wisdom is, yeah, but you do it too. And I think the real damage of that FTC suit by the Obama administration is weakening the standing of the FTC in those international settings. FTC has got a lot less capital to play with because of that suit in dealing with foreign agencies. And that's a problem that I think is going to take new leadership to solve, time to solve, and but that is an additional complication. All the more reason, I think, to expect more action from the DOJ on this point.
Very good. We do have one question pending. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's check in with the next caller.
This is Chris Garvey from Island of New York, and I've got two questions. Probably the best is to take them one at a time. There have been mergers between Google, YouTube, and Blogspot, all of which have been good tools for getting speech out for a person who doesn't have a lot of other leverage. And I've seen complaints from small blog owners and also from Alex Jones that Google has been restricting their speech, putting them in Facebook jail, putting restrictions or slowing down the Google searching that might bring them to people to their sites and their shows, and generally impeding free speech. And if these three guys hadn't been allowed to merge, the effect might have been a little less. Do you care to comment on how the FTC might have done things differently, or should do things differently, or should not do things any differently?
Sure. I'm not sure how to take the question, because I think you've sort of put facts and evidence and asked me how to respond if those facts are true, and I just don't know if they're true, right? So
right. Assume the facts.
But let me tell you. Well, yeah. So I'm not gonna. But let me tell you what I will do. You know, the FTC enforces both consumer protection and the antitrust laws, right? So some of these types of theories are raised all the time when there are mergers of, you know, folks like Google or Facebook or, you know, platforms who have rules about, you know, how one can operate on the platform, et cetera, right? So these are common sorts of theories, right? And I will say this, I mean, these are types of theories that are raised in cases, certainly when I was at the FTC, that the agencies investigate, that they take seriously, that they have the tools to investigate. So I don't think this is an issue of the authority vested in the agency. I'm going to use the FTC as an example. The authority vested in the agency being insufficient to address the types of questions that you are asking. And I think you're certainly right that these are the types of questions people ask when these mergers come up, right? I think what I can say is the agencies go to the ends of the earth to get the data and information they need to assess these theories. They reach conclusions and make recommendations to commissioners who ultimately vote on the cases. And I have no reason to think that the agencies got them wrong in the absence of sort of strong, persuasive, convincing evidence to the contrary. If you've got that, you know, I'd love to read it and see it, and, you know, I think it would be interesting. But, you know, speculating about what the agencies get right and wrong without evidence is goes against my economist brain. But these are testable theories, and I think I certainly say they are tested within the agencies internally, both by economists and lawyers.
Of course, it's much less likely that Google, YouTube, and Blogspot are going to be broken up now that they've merged together. The days of the ATT breakup are probably gone. The other question is, some of these companies are coercive monopolies. The way Cablevision got its monopoly on Long Island was that it probably paid, I mean, you can't prove this, but it probably paid local politicians to give it that monopoly. And the only reason they have competition is Verizon figured out how to get into the cable business. So there you have the internet service providers, only two of them, partly because of government action. And if you were to allow two companies like that to merge, you'd have no competition at all. Now, the FTC has been reducing their rules for internet service providers, and I thought initially, well, that's just letting these coercive monopolies run wild, but what they seem to be doing is making it possible for more ISPs to get in to the business and making it possible by using their influence as a regulator to stop the localities from stopping the ISPs from being formed, rather than loading them up with regulations that make it impossible to become an ISP. So I gather what you're saying is that the FTC is less likely to be stepping into this at all. But it bothers me a lot when two coercive monopolies merge. And it seems to me it doesn't take that much to stop them from merging. And it's the FCC's more liberal policy in terms of allowing ISPs to be formed or encouraging ISPs to be formed hasn't really taken effect yet. So it would be, in my opinion, a big mistake to allow, say, Cablevision to merge with Verizon or Optimum to merge with another cable provider.
Any further response on that?
No, I'm not sure if I heard a question for me.
Okay. Let me make a final call for questions then. If you have a question, this is the time to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we do have one more question, so let's check in with still another caller.
Good afternoon. Jane Luxton at Clark Hill. Just curious if you have any predictions about the fate of the Yates memo.
Above my pay grade. I know antitrust stuff, but it's above my pay grade, Jane. So, no, I don't think I have any predictions for you there.
Okay, thanks.
We do have another question, so let's check in with another caller if we could.
Let me phrase it more in terms of a question than a ramble. Do you think that the FTC should step in to stop local coercive monopolies from, such as cable companies, from merging with each other?
I think when mergers violate the antitrust laws, the agency should block them. That is, you know, the nature of the antitrust beast is fact intensive. There are mergers that help competition and mergers that don't. The statute lets you let the ones go that don't and attack the ones that do. Most of these, by the way, are going to the DOJ, not the FTC. It was less of an FTC versus FCC thing than a DOJ thing, who has sort of substantial industry expertise in this area. The FTC does conduct work, but less on the merger side. So my short answer is the agencies ought to block mergers that are anti-competitive, that violate the antitrust laws. Some do, some don't.
Very good. Let me give you, Josh Wright, a minute or two to wrap up if you have a final thought you want to express.
Oh, I don't have anything final to express. I think we'll wait and see, and we'll do another antitrust in the Trump administration panel teleforum when we've got personnel in.
Well, I look forward to that. My thanks to Josh Wright, our expert for today's call. We certainly appreciate it. Covered a lot of territory, I think. I also want to thank the audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled teleforum conference call. That's Monday at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about the use of statistics in civil rights law. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.